You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. The year was 1947. The Soviet Union had moved from being America's uneasy ally in the Second World War to its most feared enemy. With Joseph Stalin's ambitions pushing westward, Turkey was pressed from the east, while communist revolutionaries overran Greece. The British Empire was battered from its war with Hitler and suddenly teetering on the brink of financial ruin. Only America could afford to defend freedom in the West, and the effort was spearheaded by a president who hadn't even been elected to office. But Harry Truman would wage a domestic political battle that carried with it the highest of stakes, inspiring friends and foes alike to join in the crusade to defend democracy across the globe. Now, Joe Scarborough, host of MSNBC's Morning Joe, recounts the historic forces that moved Truman toward his country's long twilight struggle against Soviet communism in his new book, Saving Freedom: Truman, the Cold War, and the Fight for Western Civilization. And today, Joe joins me on the show to talk about our mutual affection for the politician dismissed as the strange little man from Missouri, why Truman couldn't even get respect from his own wife and mother-in-law, and how historians have gradually rehabilitated the legacy of the 33rd president. Joe tells the story of the twin crises that kicked off the Cold War and the speech that redefined U.S. foreign policy. We discuss how Truman pulled America out of its isolationist past, the Republican senator who helped him do it, and how they forged a bipartisan coalition that held for more than 70 years and eventually defeated communism. He then discusses Donald Trump's efforts to reject the Truman Doctrine and undermine long-standing alliances such as NATO, the degree to which President-elect Biden can undo Trump's disastrous foreign policy, and whether Joe, a former Republican congressman, thinks he'll ever return to the GOP. Coming up with Joe Scarborough in just a moment. Joe Scarborough is a New York Times bestselling author, a Washington Post columnist, the creator and host of Morning Joe on MSNBC, and a former United States congressman. He has been named to the Time 100 list of the world's most influential people, and now he's out with a new book called Saving Freedom: Truman, the Cold War, and the Fight for Western Civilization. Joe Scarborough, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Ben. I appreciate it.
Well, Joe, I've always been kind of a Truman nut, so I really enjoyed the book. And it sounds like your fascination with Harry Truman goes way back. In fact, when you were a Republican congressman, you actually had, you say, two portraits in your office, Ronald Reagan and Harry Truman, who was, of course, a Democrat. What was your fascination with him even back then?
Well, you know, it's interesting that I was, when I got to Congress, I was a small government conservative, and I had been, you know, when Reagan got elected, that's one of the first real elections that I followed closely. And so I was a Reagan conservative, and I ran as one. But the strange thing is that the two most compelling figures that I, uh, that really grabbed my attention in high school were Bobby Kennedy and Harry Truman. And I think what with Kennedy, it was, he was just an extraordinary character. And, you know, I always go back to the Indianapolis speech that he gave the night that Martin Luther King died. And there's just a line in there, and I guess it was my fascination with him, where he was talking about, well, actually it was a line in a speech that he gave a couple of years before in Johannesburg, in Cape Town, where he talked about bending history. He said, very few people have the ability to bend history itself. And then he goes on and he talks about the numerous events that we all can do to create a ripple, which will create a tidal wave that will knock down the mightiest walls of oppression. But that Indianapolis speech in 68 was an example of where Bobby changed history. He bent history. He went in and did something that people warned him not to do. And because of it, Indianapolis went to sleep peacefully when over 100 other cities burned. What, Harry Truman was the same way. He was far different than Bobby in that, you know, he was from middle America. He didn't go to Harvard. He went to Spalding Commercial College in Kansas City. And he nobody expected anything to happen, good to happen with Harry Truman. He had to beg his local boss to run for, well, they call it county judge, but it's basically county commissioner. He won the first time, he lost his next race, and then he had to beg to run for the Senate. And the only reason that the machine let him run for the Senate is the first four guys they went to didn't want to run. Nobody expected him to win. He won, and he kept surprising people. He won re-election in 40. FDR wouldn't even endorse him, thought he was going to lose. And time and time again, he was underestimated. But few presidents over the past 100 years have bent history as much as Harry Truman did.
Yeah, he's a real testament to staying focused on a goal, keeping on, and not letting the bastards grind you down, isn't he?
And time and time again, he was underestimated. Time and time again, he kept his head down. He did the hard work. He did all the things that, unfortunately, too many of our politicians don't do these days. And he created the world that we lived in. And the reason why I had the picture of the two pictures, one of Truman and one of Reagan, is that Harry Truman had the nerve at a time when the world was exhausted by World War II, and Americans in particular were exhausted, to actually stare down Stalin. And he started the Cold War. Reagan and Bush helped in the Cold War. But I thought it was really symbolic to have this Democrat and this Republican who were seven presidencies apart, and yet there was this continuous bipartisan line between Republican and Democratic administrations. And they had one singular goal, and that was freeing Eastern Europe. And they did it, but they did it because of the world that Harry Truman created.
Yeah, you kind of had the two bookmarks of the Cold War there. Now, I have to say, personally, I have always found him to be probably the most sympathetic of presidents, just because, as you mentioned, he never had an easy go of it. Even when he was president of the United States, and this is what's most interesting to me about that, most powerful man in the world, his wife and his own mother-in-law still treated him like a total loser, as if he was still a bankrupt haberdasher back in Kansas. I mean, what does a guy have to do?
I'm so glad you brought up the mother-in-law, because it's extraordinary.
The nightmare mother-in-law.
The nightmare mother-in-law. She did not want Harry Truman, who she considered to be a loser, a failure, to marry her daughter. And here the guy pulls himself up by his bootstraps, becomes, again, a county judge, that wasn't enough for, a United States senator, wasn't enough for, then becomes vice president, and then president of the United States of America, and lived in the White House. And she still let him know that she wasn't good enough for her daughter, and she just wasn't impressed. But this was poor Harry Truman's life from the start. You know, he was, when he became president of the United States, he was dismissed by a prominent historian and journalist at the time as a strange little man. The second he got to the Senate, United States Senate, the New York Times did a profile of him where they dismissed him as a rube. FDR's chief of staff, when they were all around in 1944 trying to figure, they knew they couldn't have Henry Wallace be president of the United States because he was like a socialist with a capital S, not a socialist like we're calling, you know, liberals in America these days. But he was a total socialist and was sympathetic towards the Soviet cause. So they're in the room and trying to figure out who to replace Wallace, and somebody mentions Harry Truman, and Roosevelt's chief of staff, Admiral William Lay, says, "Who the hell is Harry Truman?" And later they asked somebody who's inside why they picked Truman. The guy said, "We were all just tired." They dismissed
I love that quote.
as the second Missouri Compromise. Time Magazine, after he got selected as FDR's running mate, called him the mousy little man from Missouri. And even after he became president of the United States, Republicans and Democrats alike, they had a saying, "The air is Truman." When he ran for re-election in 48, you know, Democrats would hold up signs saying, "I'm just mild about Harry." This guy never got a break. He left with like a 22% approval rating. And who would have known that as he rolled back into Independence, Missouri, who would have known that this guy, who never got the respect of anybody in Washington, D.C., or even his own mother-in-law, would be the most transformative president on foreign policy stage since the end of World War II? And if you go back over the past 100, 120, 30 years, only FDR compares.
Right, right, yeah. And by the way, I think I said he was a bankrupt haberdasher in Kansas, but he was, in fact, Missouri, a bankrupt haberdasher from Missouri, if that's any better.
Right.
Now, you mentioned that he left office with one of the worst approval ratings in history, but very slowly over the recent decades, historians have started to rehabilitate his legacy. Why do you think we're just now starting to appreciate Truman?
You know, it's interesting. I think Truman in the early 60s started really speaking out, and I think he was harsh and acerbic. And I don't think it was until he passed away and the dust settled, because he kicked up a lot of dust, that historians really started taking a long second look at him. And there's no doubt that David McCullough's biography came along at a time that that I think really had people take a second look at Truman, much like Chernow's has done with Hamilton and even Grant. But I will say this, there was a growing recognition from historians even before McCullough's biography came out that this guy, again, had bent history, that this guy had created the world stage that all of the players had moved around on since he left office in January of 53, a guy that, you know, contained the Soviets with a Marshall Plan, with, of course, the Truman Doctrine, with NATO, with everything that he did. I just think over time, there was a real recognition, and perhaps it was during the Reagan presidency when they realized that the Cold War was coming to an end and that the Soviet Union was collapsing in on itself. Maybe there was a realization for the first time that somebody had done something right. As Dean Acheson would say, his extraordinary Secretary of State, you know, at the creation. I mean, they were there at the creation of this world we live in. Yeah. And he created an extraordinary structure that really started the American century.
And your book specifically focuses on the events surrounding the declaration of the Truman Doctrine, which really represented a kickoff of the Cold War and perhaps more importantly, became the guiding principle of U.S. foreign policy for the past 70 or so years. Now, this idea of America's expanded role in the world and her responsibility to support the cause of freedom and intervene when necessary in political affairs of other nations is pretty commonplace now. But back then, was it a fairly radical view?
It was a radical view, and it actually was a departure from 150, 160 years of history that you can trace all the way back to George Washington's farewell address to the nation. And as I mentioned in the book, that view of America and the world, and an America separated from the world, removed from foreign entanglements, was an idea that had taken such hold in Washington, and specifically in the United States Senate, that every year they would read Washington's farewell address in the Senate chambers. Yeah. And of course, Woodrow Wilson, after World War I, decided that the United States couldn't be isolationist, that they needed to be a force for good across the world, needed to promote democracy. And he failed miserably in trying to get the League of Nations through.
Right.
And there was an understanding with Harry Truman that they couldn't make the same mistake, that the Truman administration couldn't make the same mistake that the Wilson administration had made, which was, you know, throw down their marker, say, this is our view, accept it, or basically go to hell. And so Truman began working with the people that he had served with in the Senate, Arthur Vandenberg, who was the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, even Mr. Republican himself, Robert Taft, who is a dyed-in-the-wool isolationist, and ended up getting all of their votes for the Truman Doctrine, which I would guess nobody would have predicted at the beginning of the process. But what Truman did, and what I try to outline in the book, is Truman did the hard work. His staff did the hard work. His Secretary of State did the hard work. They all did the hard work by going up to the Hill and just working tirelessly and around the clock and giving the Republicans what they wanted. You have 150 questions about you know, our legislation of, you know, aiding Greece and Turkey. Okay, we'll get those answers back to you in like the next week. And we're constantly working. And they had to work a little harder. They had to try a little harder because, as you know, Republicans had been in the minority since FDR took office in January of 1933. And I'd been in the minority for 14 years at least by the time Truman was going up on the Hill and trying to get them to pass the Truman Doctrine. So Republicans weren't really in the mood to listen to a Democratic president tell them how to reorder 150 years of American history and American foreign policy. But Harry Truman and his able staff succeeded in doing it, which is pretty remarkable.
It is. It is. You don't see that these days. No. Now, let's talk about these twin crises in Greece and Turkey that really kicked things off. First of all, what was happening in Greece in early 1947?
Well, Greece has been in a permanent civil war for about 3,000 years. So Greece was in another civil war, and the Americans really didn't have a good choice. There was a right-wing government in Greece that Great Britain had been the protectorate of, and they were fighting communists. And so At the beginning of the book, I talk about the first chapter of Dean Acheson getting a note from the British ambassador who basically said, "No mas, we can't help anymore. Our empire is exhausted. We have no more aid to provide. We'll do what little we can do, but Greece is either going to sink or swim based on what the United States does." And so that caused the crisis that forced Truman to start moving towards trying to get aid from Congress for the right-wing government in Greece. And what was so interesting about it is, and I think it's very appropriate, that the Cold War kicked off with Harry Truman and the United States Congress having to choose between two very bad options. You can either support the communists who were taking people out of their houses and shooting them, or you could support the right-wing government in Greece who was taking communists and communist supporters out of their homes and shooting them. And so they, of course, pressured the Greek government to reform. But Truman was very straightforward, and I think this was important, very, very straightforward from the very beginning with the Republican Congress, said, hey, there are not angels on either side, and we're going to have to push the Greeks to reform and to be more democratic. But we can't give Stalin, we can't give the communists, we can't give the Soviet Union a foothold in Greece, or else we'll be in trouble. So it went back and forth, and we eventually, Truman eventually got the aid, and after the aid, it took a little while, but we eventually helped the Greeks turn the tide there.
Yeah, there is a certain amount of hypocrisy to the idea that we were defending one oppressive regime from another.
Right.
But then, you know, that's a pattern that we repeated over and over in the 70 years that followed. It's a tough decision to make.
Yeah, it is. And again, I think it's very appropriate that the first decision, it wasn't clean cut. Mm-hmm. Because we saw that time and time again. And of course, we usually ended up getting it right. But occasionally you had the tragedies of Vietnam, where, of course, it took us 20, 30 years to be removed from Vietnam to understand that the North Vietnamese were fighting more of a war of nationalism than they were a war of communism. But for the most part, again, with the mistakes along the way, we did end up in 1989 watching the Berlin Wall fall and watching 80, 90 million Europeans being freed. But yeah, there were tough choices along the way, financially, but also morally. Henry Kissinger, who should know about this better than anybody else, famously said that foreign policy is never a choice between a good and bad option. It's a choice between two bad options, and you have to choose the least of the bad options.
Now, Turkey was a little bit of a different situation from Greece, but why were these two crises viewed as a piece from the U.S. perspective?
Well, it's interesting. Turkey and Greece were viewed together, despite the fact everybody in the Truman administration and even on Capitol Hill understood the more direct threat was to Greece. Mm-hmm. But there's no doubt that Stalin also had his eyes on Turkey, and it was because of its geographic positioning actually caused the United States far more concern. But they wanted to focus first on Greece and believe that if they took care of the crisis in Greece, that Turkey would take care of itself. And at the end, it ended up doing that. They got the aid for Greece and Turkey. And by the time they got the aid and by the time they had success in Greece, Stalin came to the realization that it just wasn't worth the fight.
Beyond just the general goal of expanding into Europe, was there a more specific strategic importance of Turkey to Stalin?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was the expansion into Europe, but also Stalin saw Greece and Turkey as strategic, and just like Iran, they were actually sort of nosing around in Iran for a warm weather port. Warm water port, but for Turkey, it was more of a geographic bridge to Europe, and was Stalin, you know, Stalin's attempt to expand, and they were also pushing, of course, in France, and they were pushing in Italy. These were just the first two places that America focused on.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. And Now, I want to talk about Truman's advisors. You mentioned a few of them a moment ago. Truman surrounded himself with the greatest minds in foreign policy, men like George Marshall, Dean Acheson, and unlike Trump, they weren't just the best and brightest on the day he hired them, and then bums and losers as soon as they left. Yeah. They really were an A-team. Talk about the importance of his foreign policy brain trust and what they brought to the table.
Well, I think it says a lot of, about Harry Truman, again, this graduate from Spalding Commercial College in Kansas City, that he would surround himself with the best and the brightest, but also that he had the confidence to keep most of FDR's men on board. At the top of that list, General George Marshall, and it's really hard for us to understand how any one figure could be as revered as George Marshall was in 1945 when Harry Truman took office. Marshall was in a league of his own. He discovered Eisenhower. He really was the great organizer for the Second World War. When he came back, there was a moment I talk about in the book that tells you how Marshall was sort of an island unto himself and could do what no other man or woman could do in Washington, D.C. And it was when FDR was talking to Marshall, and he turned to him and said, George, what I just said, you agree with that, right? And Marshall, who, unlike everybody else that was ever asked that leading question by FDR, said, well, no, Mr. President. In fact, I disagree with it very, very much. And FDR looked at him, you know, turned, snapped his head back. And to FDR's credit, he kept Marshall on. He even continued promoting him. Never called him George again. It was always General after that. But Marshall stood alone. And that's why he was so important to Harry Truman in conveying the needs of this country, mm-hmm. to members of Congress. And it's interesting, Marshall had a bigger play in the Truman Doctrine than he did in the Marshall Plan. Harry Truman knew that he could sell the Marshall Plan more easily if he put George Marshall's name on it. So Marshall was extraordinary. Dean Acheson was extraordinary. He was actually a pretty arrogant guy. You just look at his biography, autobiography. It's called President the Creation. that tells you an awful lot. But, you know, he went to Groton. Then he went to Yale, then he went to Harvard Law School, and he made no secret of the fact that he had little use for members of the United States Senate and less use for members of the House, was openly contemptuous of them in a way that probably made Republican chairman's jobs a little more difficult in pulling along. But Acheson was extraordinarily gifted as well. And in those days, having the number two in charge of the State Department being that effective was important, because, you know, Marshall would fly across Europe and be gone for a month at a time. And it was important that he knew that when he left, he had somebody like Dean Acheson in charge. And Acheson really was sort of the mastermind that guided all of the Truman Doctrine through from beginning to end.
In these discussions, I wonder, at any point, was military intervention on the table?
No, not really. There was one moment when they were talking about pushing Stalin and pushing the Soviets by sending military advisors, a term of art that we used time and time again in Vietnam. As well, of course, but doing that to push the outcome in America's direction, and Dwight Eisenhower was in a meeting where he actually expressed concern about the possibility of military intervention, and that it could provoke the Soviets, and Harry Truman told him curtly that he understood that, but they were going to move ahead anyway.
And one of the arguments that we heard from non-interventionists was that the UN would be better suited to deal with the situation in Greece and Turkey. But the UN at that point, I think, was only 2 years old. Would it have been well equipped to handle a crisis like this?
No, not at all. But looking back to this time and doing research, I found it pretty astounding how much weight Americans put in the United Nations as an institution. They had great confidence in the UN. They believed that it was an international organization that was going to stand between them and world wars in the future. They had great faith, great confidence that the United Nations really would shoulder a lot of the burdens that the United States had to shoulder in World War I and World War II. And there were times when the Truman Doctrine hit a roadblock because the polls were showing at the time, Gallup polls were showing at the time, and members of Congress were echoing what they were hearing at home, that a lot of Americans believed the United Nations should be taking the lead in Greece and Turkey and not the United States. And so at each given time, they would have America's representative to the United Nations explain how this was not going to undermine the UN and that actually it would be of great help to them. But it was at that time, it was a symbolic institution, even though Americans didn't realize it at the time. And of course, we did fight the Korean War under the UN banner, but it was American soldiers that fought and bled and died far more than some mystical international peacekeeping force.
Now, even though, as we said, Truman's staff and Senator Vandenberg kind of laid the groundwork for a deal, Truman took it upon himself to give the final sales pitch for aid to Greece and Turkey in a now famous address to Congress on March 12, 1947. What went into that speech, striking the right tone and sounding the alarm without overdoing it and getting us into a war?
Right.
What was all the thinking that went into that?
Well, it's interesting. Dean Acheson helped put the speech together. They also had the aid of Clark Clifford, who was at that point just a young aide who had caught Harry Truman's attention by organizing some of his poker games. But they tried to not overplay their hand. They tried to not provoke Stalin and the Soviet Union. In fact, they never mentioned the Soviet Union by name, or of course Stalin by name in the speech, but it's very clear what this was all about. But even with them taking the extra care that they took and not appearing to be trying to appear too aggressive, when Marshall saw the first draft of the speech, he edited several parts because he thought it was a little too hot, a little too provocative for Stalin and the Soviets. So they were very careful to try to strike the right tone. But ended up writing a speech that they knew would depend, all the aides knew would depend on the content of the speech and not from the president's delivery of the speech, because they're very aware of how limited Harry Truman was when it came to his speaking style. He was not FDR. He was not JFK or Ronald Reagan. He was a guy who graduated from Spalding Commercial College, as I keep saying, that really didn't have a flair when it came to speaking, but it carried the day. The content of the speech carried the day, and Truman, they tried to make the best of Truman's plain speaking style, but there was Clifford going through the whole speech and, you know, Acheson would have a word and he would strike through it and make it something that sounded more appropriate for Harry Truman's style.
Now, during Truman's presidency, he orchestrated the Berlin Airlift, the Marshall Plan, as we mentioned, the formation of NATO, America's defense of South Korea. Do you think that any of those things would have happened if he hadn't already laid the groundwork for a bipartisan coalition during the crisis in Greece and Turkey?
I think it would have been very hard because by putting together the Truman Doctrine, by approaching the challenges of Greece and Turkey, the Republicans, who again were skeptical and isolationists, the Republicans understood that this had much more to do than just two countries. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Atchison found himself in a very interesting position going in front of Vandenberg in the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. He was, of course, worried that the Republicans would think that it was, in fact, a global, more of a sort of worldview. And when Atchison kept saying it was limited to Greece and Turkey, when senators, Republican senators, were asking questions, Vandenberg kept interrupting and kept trying to get him to expand out, you know, the scope of this remedy. Because Vandenberg understood, as did most of the Republicans, that Greece and Turkey might be the first battle in this long-running Cold War, but there were going to be many other challenges. So I think it's a great point you make that it would have been much more difficult for Truman, for his administration, for the Republican Congress to address each one of these challenges in an ad hoc sort of way, because while Truman was worried about the Soviet Union moving into Greece or the Soviet Union moving into Turkey or into Europe, there was also an extraordinary refugee crisis across Europe following World Right. War II, one of the great refugee crises of all times. And it's interesting that to get help in that crisis, Truman reached out to none other than Herbert Hoover, who had been in the political wilderness for 14, 15 years, who Republicans used as a punching bag in every single campaign. But he had also been the man who helped organize relief efforts after World War I. So Truman called him up, called him in, and they worked together. And as Herbert Hoover said, to Harry Truman when they were working, he basically said, a hungry European is a future communist. Mm-hmm. We've got to take care of their basic needs. And we'll be doing that not only for the humanitarian reasons, but also for geopolitical reasons. And sure enough, that proved to be right. And so most of the Republicans understood by the end of the Truman Doctrine debate exactly what was at stake in Europe.
Right. And I think that's something that we've lost sight of recently, is particularly with the Marshall Plan. It underscores this ability for humanitarian aid to also serve a strategic purpose. It wasn't just selfless altruism or some kind of wasted investment. And particularly, I don't think Donald Trump understands that.
No, this country has fed and freed more people than any other country in the history of the world. And yes, we were doing it for humanitarian purposes, but there were also strategic reasons why the United States did what they did, and the two go together. And it is something that's been really maddening that my former party, I'm an independent now, but my former Republican Party has never really understood how foreign aid and reaching out to other countries and helping others in times of need doesn't come back to help you at all. And this is a much bigger issue about, and one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book at the time that I wrote the book is that Donald Trump believed from the very beginning that things like the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine and this post-war order that Harry Truman created was a waste, that it made us out to be suckers, that we were giving money to the Europeans and receiving nothing in return. Nothing can be further from the truth. You look at America's GDP And it skyrocketed after World War II, and it continued to skyrocket after World War II, because what we did was we created a world order that allowed everybody else to profit. But who profited the most from that? The United States. And yes, it was maddening at times for Americans in the early 1970s to see made in Japan on more and more items and on more electronic items. And in the mid 70s, when Japanese cars started to sell in the United States, I mean, people like Donald Trump would look at that and see that as a failure of U.S. policy. Actually, wasn't a failure. It made our cars better, made our economy more competitive, and made the world economy grow. It's something that, unfortunately, my party and the current president just never really seemed to understand.
Yeah, Donald Trump's America First style of foreign policy, if you can even call it a foreign policy, flies directly in the face of the Truman Doctrine and has gone a long way to reverse all that we've accomplished over the last 70 or so years. Mm-hmm. How much of that can be undone by Joe Biden the moment he steps into office, and how much of it, the actions and the words of Trump, have left lasting wounds in these relationships around the globe that may be a little tougher to fix?
Well, this has been an ongoing debate between Mika and myself for the past 4 years. Mika does believe that much of what Donald Trump has done to damage this country and its reputation across the globe is irreparable. I don't believe that's the case. I think, especially when it comes to European allies and our friends in Canada and Mexico and across the world, I think we're going to be able to rebuild those relationships very quickly. The United States remains the indispensable power across the globe. I think what's been lost, though, not just in during the Trump years, but also in the 21st century, the past 20 years, I think, is we have given the Chinese strategic leg up on us, in that the first 10 years of this century, while we were fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and across the globe, they were making strategic partnerships in Africa and Europe and in other countries. And the Obama administration, we had a foreign policy that was focused mainly on not making mistakes, not doing stupid stuff, as Barack Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic. So it was actually a foreign policy that was more back on its heels, because the president then was focused on not, almost exclusively on not being Bush and Cheney. In the last 4 years also, we've lost ground to China, in large part because Angela Merkel and other Europeans understood a few years back they couldn't count on the United States anymore, didn't know if Donald Trump was going to be around for two terms. So started looking eastward, started looking to China, and opened up more trading relationships with China. Donald Trump constantly was talking about the pipeline between Russia and Germany that seemed to enrage him. But really, he was antagonizing our European allies over the past 4 years. So they had to look. They had to look elsewhere. So I think we've lost some advantage to the Chinese over the past 4 years. But again, I hope I don't sound arrogant like a member of the British Empire in 1944. Right. But we are the United States, God damn it. It's the worst British accent ever.
It's pretty bad.
It was horrible. I'm usually better than that, being a Beatles fan the way I am and a Churchill fan. But we're still the United States. We still have an extraordinary, vibrant economy. We still lead the world in technological ingenuity. We still have so many built-in advantages that it seems to me that if we reverse course, not just over the past 4 years, but the past 20 years, we have a chance to regain some of that momentum.
Well, real quickly before we go, from repairing America's standing in the world to repairing the Republican Party, I have to ask you, as you mentioned, you left the Republican Party in 2017 to become an independent.
Yeah.
What do you see the post-Trump GOP looking like? And can you ever see yourself coming back into the fold?
Never. I am pragmatic and I never say never.
Okay.
But when it comes to the Republican Party, I can say I will never, ever be a member of the Republican Party again. What they have done over the past 4 years, what they have gone along with Donald Trump over the past 4 years is simply inexcusable.
Yeah.
And what's been happening over the past few weeks, really? You talk about the grand finale of this shock opera that has been the Trump presidency. They're all coming out on stage for one final, you know, big chorus. I'm sick and tired of Republicans telling me one thing off the air and then telling reporters something else on the air. What Donald Trump's doing right now is undemocratic, it's un-American, it's authoritarian. The fact that he's been sending Rudy Giuliani, poor Rudy Giuliani, you're talking about elder abuse, sending Rudy Giuliani around to embarrass himself in courtrooms across the upper Midwest is just absolutely disgraceful. Those cases aren't going anywhere. Mitch McConnell knows that. Yeah. The Republicans know that. In fact,
right.
Some have actually said it, like Pat Toomey, a Republican senator from Pennsylvania, said this is going nowhere. Scott Walker, former governor of Wisconsin, said you could do a recount, but it's not going to make a difference. They understand it's not going to make a difference. We saw in Wayne County a couple of nights ago, two local bureaucrats who were supposed to just sort of check the box and say that the election was fine, certify the election results, actually refused to do it at first until under pressure, and then Donald Trump, you know, started calling them. Now Donald Trump is reportedly calling legislators from states asking them to fly to the White House because he knows he lost the election. He knows he's not going to be able to stop the certification of these races. So now he is trying to upend the Electoral College and trying to get these state legislators to actually negate millions and millions of votes. So, I mean, the fact that the Republican Party continues to go along with this undemocratic, un-American routine is shocking, but it's really it's really disappointing, and I will use the word, it is deplorable.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know what they're scared of. You know, he's gone. He's not a threat to you. He's not going to be probably primarying you in the next election. What are they afraid of? What are they holding on to? It's so strange.
Well, it's a good question. You know, the thing is, when I was a Republican, I criticized George W. Bush in his second term for his foreign policy, which I said it was a Wilsonian foreign policy. And I wrote books attacking George W. Bush for spending too much money, for Republicans being hypocrites when it came to deficits, when it came to debt. And man, I was attacked. I mean, the same people that are attacking me now, the same people who were attacking me now were attacking me. How dare you go after the president of the United States? You're a socialist. I was like, wait, I'm actually arguing that they're spending too much money. I'm still a small government conservative. The second Bush left town, they turned on him immediately. Yeah. I remember telling somebody who had worked for me in Scarborough Country, which was a show long ago on MSNBC, who went to work for the Bush White House, called me up and was yelling at me for something that I had done on the air. And this was like in 2005. I said, listen, George W. Bush is not going to be around forever. I am. I need to know, am I your friend or not? I was like, they don't own the White House. They only rent it. And she said, you're my friend. I said, okay, good. Let's always remember that. And sure enough, Bush left town. Republicans turned on him. Trump's going to leave town. And I know people are saying, oh, Donald Trump will control this party for years. No, he won't. When you lose, you get pushed to the side. And it's going to happen. Who knows? Maybe he'll influence some races 2 years from now, like Sarah Palin did in 2010. But there is definitely a shelf life on Donald Trump controlling the Republican Party. I don't know where it goes, but I've got to say right now, I don't really care because chances are good it's not going to be a good place.
Yeah. Well, let's just hope that these are the most uneventful 2 months in history coming up.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Knock on wood on that one.
Well, folks, again, Joe Scarborough's book is called Saving Freedom, Truman, the Cold War, and the Fight for Western Civilization. And of course, you can catch him weekday mornings on Morning Joe on MSNBC. Joe, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Ben. I really appreciate it so much.
Thanks again to Joe Scarborough for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Saving Freedom, Truman, the Cold War, and the Fight for Western Civilization on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Watch his program Morning Joe on weekday mornings from 6 to 9 Eastern on MSNBC and follow Joe on Twitter at JoeNBC. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis and thanks for listening to KickAss News.